The Swinging Palm Trees podcast with Akin.
Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, and whatever time you are listening to this. My name is Akin, and welcome to the Swinging Palm Trees podcast, where we talk about the quotes and the sayings that have had an impact on our lives, be they spiritual, philosophical, mundane, or even pop cultural. We'll talk about them. My guest today is young director and future Academy Award winner, as far as I'm concerned.
Amen.
Mr. Tomisin Adepeju. Adepeju. Is it Adepeju? Adepeju.
Adepeju.
Adepeju. There you that's go,
it.
Then.
You've got to have that Nigerian twang.
You've got to have that twang. So it's Mr. Tomisin Adepeju on today's episode. Tomisin, thank you so much for joining us on today's gig.
My absolute pleasure. Thank you for inviting me.
So kindly tell us just a little bit about yourself.
So yes, I was born in Nigeria in 1989. I lived there until I was about 12 years old. And when I was 12, my parents just told us one day, hey guys, guess what? We're coming to England. And I was like, why? And I didn't have a say in the matter, you know. So me and my siblings were just thrust from the heat and craziness of Lagos life to the sort of cold and drabness of London life. And it was a culture shock, really. And I've been here since, really. I'm 31 now, so I've been in this country for 19 years altogether. So still trying to get used to the cold. Yeah.
So can you remember what time of the year it was you came into the country?
Came probably the worst time. So we came November 2002. Post 9/11 Britain as well. Right. So it was a very strange time to even be in this country in that time. Mm. It was just cold. I remember leaving the airport, right? And I left and I stepped on the streets and suddenly my mouth, there was this stuff coming out of it. And I was like, what is this weird, strange? And my mom was like, oh, it's because it's cold. And I'm like, what's cold? I didn't even understand what being cold meant, because, you know, when you're raised in the heat, that's all you know. And then you talk and there was this stuff coming out of your mouth. And I thought, yeah, this is not Lagos. I'm not home anymore.
Don't you have any recollections of Harmattan back in Nigeria, the Harmattan season?
Harmattan was not cold, though. I mean, if you compare Harmattan to the cold here, Harmattan was literally summer, really, because it's like it was a bit colder, you know. But I mean, I went back to Nigeria recently during Harmattan and I was like, this is Harmattan? Like when you've tasted October cold in England, you're like, yeah, Harmattan is not, you know, all the Nigerians, they hate Harmattan, but I'm like, guys, come to London, you know.
Well, you say that, but you did grow up in Lagos. So compared to going to maybe Oyo State or Osun State, then going further up to maybe to Kwara, then going more up to Sokoto, then.
True. Very, very true. That's very different.
So from looking at your life, and is it fair to call you a visual storyteller?
Yes. Yes, it is.
Okay. Yes. All right.
And most people don't call me that, actually. Most just call me a storyteller. So I think it's important that you've emphasized the visual part of it there. So
Tomisin, how would you like me to pronounce your first name? Because I'm so used to calling people Tosin or Tomi. So when I hear, do you mind me calling you Tomi for the time being? Because I always trip over the name Tomisin.
Tomisin. No, that's absolutely fine.
Okay. So tell us a bit about you, the storyteller, and how you actually started your career.
So I came here when I was 12, and there was no inclination of even embarking in anything visual or cinematic, or, you know, I think I was on course to become a lawyer ultimately, because as you know, when you're Nigerian, you know, your parents expect you to have certain jobs that involved a war, which means money, you know. So, and law, medicine, accounting, there was a list of jobs basically that we had to do. And for me, I don't know, I always say cinema found me, because I was, I came when I was 12, and from the ages 12 to 15, there was this sort of loneliness I felt, you know, because I left all my friends back home. I was sort of isolated. My accent was so Nigerian that in school, people mocked me. They called me names, African boy. And so I didn't have a lot of friends in school. And I went into year eight, and year eight was, it was a mostly black school where you had all these people from Jamaica who they called me all these names, and I just didn't really feel that I fitted in anywhere. So it was a very lonely kind of growing up experience where I was just on my own a lot.
May I ask a question? How did they call you by your first name?
They didn't. You know, they didn't even mention my name. They because they couldn't pronounce it. Yeah, they couldn't pronounce it. You know, they just called me African boy. So my title to all the Oyinbo people, which is white people, all the Jamaicans, West Indians, they just called me African boy because I had this, such a Lagosian accent, very strong accent. They thought I just come from the boat, you know, and I just arrived in this country. And so African boy was my title.
It's interesting you say that because I was born in the UK, but I left when I was 7. And I have I had a strong English accent or British accent in Nigeria. And I grew up in Ibadan. And every time people would call me and say, London boy, English boy. And I'd say, no, you know, my other name is Gbenga. And they say, Gbenga, say something in English, speak in English. To the point that whenever it came to reading in classrooms, the teachers would never ask anyone else to read. They'd always say, Gbenga, read a book.
Wow.
Read to the class. So when I hear your story about trying to fit in, and yet you have this disconnect because people weren't connecting you to who you are culturally, I find it interesting.
Similar experiences. It's just sort of like, it's reversed in a sense where obviously I was trying to fit in here and I was called African boy. You were called London British boy, you know, and I've realized we're given these titles that we don't claim or want. And these titles become part of our identity in a sense, because I was always just the African boy for as long as I was in school. You were kind of the Oyinbo British boy, you know, and I think that, yeah, we have to live with that in a sense. And I think we grapple with what that means for us as well, because I was grappling with, wow, am I African boy? Maybe I am African boy, you know, and I tried to be un-African as a result of that.
You know, the funny thing about that is that when people say African boy, okay, get it right. When you say African, are you referring to North Africa, South Africa, East or West? And you don't have to delve in deeper. Are you saying South African or Namibian or Botswanian? Yeah. Or if you're talking about British, that even those who are born in England from Yorkshire never classify themselves as English.
Wow.
As far as they're concerned, they're from Yorkshire.
Wow.
So it's interesting whereby, like you said, the identities that are placed upon us, but then with knowledge and understanding, we say, no, that's not who we are. And we're not defined by what people describe us as. But anyway, let's continue back to your story. So
that's fascinating. No, because I'll add to your point, because what actually happened to me was the opposite of that, where I didn't fight against that. I actually embraced the otherness of that. So I was called African boy. I did my best to be not African. So I wanted to become British boy, actually, in a sense where I was like, yeah, because they told me I was African. I was like, no, I actually wanted to change my accent. I wanted to be British because at that age, you want to be liked. You want to make friends. You know, it's not nice being isolated, man. It's a horrible feeling being in a school of people who they just see you as African. And I didn't like my Africanness. You know, I wanted to rebel against that. You know, whereas you would think that I would maybe embrace that more and be like, yes, I am African. But at that age, no. you know, you want to be like everybody else.
Of course. So you decided when you were younger that you wanted to be a filmmaker. You decided you wanted to get into visual storytelling. And no doubt your parents have been quite supportive, because if not, we wouldn't be having this conversation right now.
Oh, yeah.
But your very first feature, official feature, was at the age of 18. And that was for your first film called The Stranger.
Oh, wow. You've done your research. My God. Yeah. I haven't heard that film in a long time. It's
so incredible. So walk us through that. You're 18 years old and you've decided I'm going to be my own version of Steven Spielberg or Akira Kurosawa at 18. What was that like?
So I say film found me, because when I was 13, right, I was just like isolated on my own. And what happened was, because I didn't have a lot of friends, I just began to watch films to change my accent. So I had a strong African accent, right? And I thought, wait, I want to sound like all these guys in my class. I want to be British. So it began with watching the news. So I would watch the news and literally repeat how they spoke. And then I thought, okay, let me try film. So I would watch British films. I watched EastEnders, Hollyoaks, all the soaps. And then I then graduated to watching British films and then American films. And then I was like, wait, what is this medium? You know, I realized that I was transported to all these countries all around the world from my living room in South London. And I thought, wow, I don't know what this medium is, but I want to watch more of it. So I just watched. And then when I was 16, when you had to choose what you wanted to do, I realized that I didn't even know what a director was. I just knew that I wanted to be in cinema. I told my parents, they weren't very, we had a big argument. Like, what are you doing? You know, are you crazy? Why do you want to do cinema? You know,
why
they were
you want to
off.
Do film? Why do you want to do film? Eh? Kilon Shea, what is wrong with you?
Exactly what my dad
do you think
said.
We
literally,
came all the
I'm
way from Nigeria facts. Just to come over here for you to study film? Over Kilon film? We didn't share any.
I can hear that in my head. You know what? This is actually too creepy. I'm hearing my dad's voice in your voice because he said exactly the same thing. He was not happy, you know. And I was the good son. I never argued with my parents. I was respectful. As you know, you're raised to Nigerian, you're dutiful, you know, loyal, all of these things. But when he said I had to do law, I was like, no, sorry. Like, film became my calling, I felt, because I basically was so comfortable in film. It was this, you know, safe space where I could get lost in all these stories from, you know, from France, from Spain, from India, you know, like, and I was like, wow, there's so many beautiful cinema. And I realized, you know what? I wanted to become a filmmaker. And then I realized what a director does. I realized a director is the anchor of this world. You know, it's his vision. You know, through the help of his actors, through his crew, he realizes his vision. So when I was 18, I thought, yeah, let me, and I had never made a film before. And I thought, let me just try this. So it was shot in my house. You know, my siblings was the crew members. My friends were, I was in it. I played the lead character. And and it was a 9-minute short film called The Stranger. And when I made it that summer, before I went to university, I knew that I was born to be a filmmaker because the film is terrible, but it wasn't even about the film. It was the process of making that film. I realized I just love this so much, you know.
So what were your parents' reaction on seeing your first quote-unquote feature?
It was actually the short film I made. They didn't even see it. I think I showed it to them. They were like, what's this nonsense? What is? They had no... I don't think they've seen it until this day. Maybe they've seen it now, but no, they didn't. Because they were still reading about the fact that I wanted to do this. Because when you go to... Because in university, I did film and TV studies, which is a film theory course. And they wanted me to do something else. So they were not interested in watching my film at all. Because for them, I had gone against what they wanted me to do, and they felt that I was disrespectful to them. And they weren't happy about it. So I don't think they've seen the film, to be honest. But I didn't care, to be honest.
And that leads us to an interesting segue to one of your features that I watched this morning called The Good Son. And I have to say, I really enjoyed watching this short, especially most of it spoken in Yoruba. And the title is Omodada. So when I saw it, I said to myself, okay, this guy knows exactly what it means to incorporate his heritage into the storytelling. So for those who have not watched this short, tell us a bit about what The Good Son is all about.
So I always say that's my first short film. And I say that for a very specific reason, because I made that film when I was 25 years old, so 6 years ago. And before making that film, I went to university. I immersed myself in film theory. I was watching films by Jean-Luc Godard. I was watching films by Kurosawa. All these, you know, foreign directors. And it was a whole new world for me because I'd only seen American films mostly. And that was incredible. So I left university with this world cinema, seeing films from Italy, films from Iran, incredible films that changed my perspective of what cinema could be. So I left when I was 21 and I was like, okay, I'm ready. I'm going to go out and make a film. But then all my friends weren't really keen to really help me make films, right? And I was just kind of in limbo for like a whole year, you know? So I got a job in the theater working as an usher, which was great. And it was good and bad because it was good because I got to watch plays for free. It was bad because it wasn't what I wanted to do. But what I did was during those years of working as an usher, I saved up £14,000. Because I wanted to do a master's in filmmaking. Because I realized that film theory is great, but I wanted to learn films practically. I wanted to know, how do I work with actors? How do I write scripts? But from 21 to 24, the films, I was making films with some friends, but the films had just white people. in it. You know, I wasn't making films about my culture because I was still a bit ashamed of who I was, I would say. I wanted to make films that were commercial, films that would be liked by, and I was still really being like my 12-year-old self where I was trying to fit in. It wasn't until I went to film school, my master's program at 24, where I was in a class of 20 people. I was the only Black person there. And my lecturer called me and said, why are you casting white people in your films? Why are you making films like all these, like everybody else in the class? You are Nigerian. Your cultural heritage is so unique because no one knows what it's like to be not only Nigerian, but to be English. Because, you know, you're not just one, you're both. So why don't you explore this? And I was like, no, I don't want to do that. I want to make films, you know. I was making films about, you know, relationships and families, but nothing really about my culture. But I really went home and thought, wait, what the hell am I doing? Like, why am I embracing an identity that isn't fully me? Because my name is Oluwatominsin Adepeju. My name is my identity. And as hard as I tried to be British, I was never really fully accepted as an Englishman, really, because of the color of my skin, because of my name, because of my culture. So I fully thought, you know what, let me just try and imbue a bit of my culture in my work. And The Good Son was actually born out of that. And it's the first film I made, I always say, because it's the first personal film I made. Because at the time I had a girlfriend who was white. And I've always thought, wow, what if she met my parents? How would they react? So that film is personal, bro. That film is personal. It's not fiction, Shai. It's not fiction.
Except for the pregnancy bit.
That wasn't true. Yes, that was made up. Yes. I didn't get anyone pregnant, bro. I would be disowned if that happened, bro.
No, because I saw the film this morning and I found it so interesting and powerful at the same time, because growing up in Nigeria, there's certain things you don't do. You don't bring home a girl pregnant. That's not happening. You don't do that.
Definitely not.
Unless you're married. And then there's a certain expectation from parents towards their kids. Good education, don't impregnate a girl, you know, and maintain the family name. And you touch on that in this short, especially when the mother's talking in Yoruba to the son saying, you've dishonored us. And to this day, my mother would say to me, Rante omoni ti oje, which translates as remember of who you're from. So when I see that in this short, I just thought to myself, I really enjoy your visual storytelling. It's powerful stuff. So kudos to you for that one. In terms of the cast, the actress who plays the role of the mum, she is amazing, if I may say myself.
She is. Absolutely. She's breathtaking. And finding her was even difficult because, you know, when I wanted to make that film, I knew that it was going to be in 70% Yoruba, which was, for me at the time, a very questionable thing. And I was unsettled about that choice because I never made anything Yoruba before. You know, all my films I've been in English, but I realized that my mom speaks Yoruba to me up until this day. So in my house, I grew up here in Yoruba. Why don't I just have Yoruba? But also I realized that we have all these foreign language films, French films, Italian films, Spanish films in their language, but they're celebrated. Why don't I try and do that for my own work where my film is a foreign language film? It's in a language that is not English. So I really wanted to embrace that. But trying to find her was difficult because she works in IT. That's her job. So she's not really an actress. So when I found her, she'd done a few local plays, but she had not done any film before. So, and as you know, Nigerians were very expressive people. We exaggerate a lot. I didn't want to make a Nollywood film. I wanted to make a film that was very subtle, very nuanced. So I found her through Facebook because I went on my Facebook and said, I'm trying to find an actress, ages 40 to 50. You know, if you know anyone, can you just tag their names in there? Because I had gone through all the normal routes of trying to find actors. I went on casting websites. I'd asked, you know, casting directors. They didn't know anyone that could act and speak Yoruba. So honestly, a friend of mine tagged her, right? And then she messaged me and said, oh, hey, I heard you're looking for actors. I've done some plays in Nigeria. I've done some also plays in London. I've never done any film. So I was a bit anxious. I was like, she's not done any film work. What if she's not very good? She came to audition and she was just incredible. I was like, wow, I found my lead actress. But then I was trying to find the character of the husband. in the film. And then she said, my husband actually acts as well. Can I send him the script? I was like, yeah, please. So, you know, he got the script, he auditioned, and he was brilliant, and I cast them both in the film. And that's working with them both was, I was just so lucky because I've made 3 films with her now, and I want to make everything that I do with her because she is incredible. You know, she was able to embody the characters so well.
And you've been featured by the feature film circuit, been recognized by BAFTA, I believe. BAFTA?
Yeah. My work has played in a few BAFTA qualifying festivals. And because I mean, since The Good Son, I've made about 4 shorts since then. So
yes, you have. And you've also debuted some work at Sundance, the Sundance Film Festival.
I have actually, yes. Yeah. Which was incredible because it had always been a lifelong dream to play in Sundance because I think it's one of the best festivals in the world. And to go there with my work and my cast and crew was a really life-changing experience. I think it's what led me to where I am now because that was a film I made called The Right Choice, a short film I directed in 2017. Yeah, that was a wonderful experience. Just meeting people in the industry, networking as well, and just sharing that experience. It really made me realize that I'm in the right industry. I am doing the right thing. It justified it as well to my parents who were, of course, very unsure about my choice of career. I think that perhaps made them realize, well, okay, he's not terrible. You know, he's not that bad. Let's maybe support him a little bit, you know.
So question, how did you find the weather in Utah?
Oh, man. Because I always wear suits, so I don't own any other clothes but suits. I went there with my shoes, my black shoes, you know, with my suit. And no one told me how cold it was going to be. I mean, it was freezing. I nearly slipped a few times. I think I actually fell down a few times because, I didn't bring any boots. You know, I came there like I was going to like a business meeting or something, you know, and it was cold. It was very cold. But, you know, a lot of hot coffees and because I was there for 10 days overall. And honestly, every day was just, it was like I was in a dream world, you know, like twinning your film in front of 700 people, you know, meeting like, you know, my heroes, going there with my cast and crew. Because Sundance, as you know, it's a reputable festival that has launched the work of so many iconic directors. So to be there was just so humbling for me.
That's really great to know. Do you have any regrets?
Oh, no, absolutely no. I think for me, it became very clear that God had called me to this choice of work. Because I always say, you know, I didn't find film. Film found me. If we didn't leave Nigeria, I would not be a filmmaker. I can tell you that for a fact. Because, you know, Nollywood is a booming industry, but no one readily goes to join the industry in a sense. I think ultimately, me coming to this country was meant to happen because it led me to film. And then film has led me to talking to you this afternoon. I wouldn't even be talking to you if I didn't come to this country. So these choices that my parents made in their life has really influenced my path. And I don't have any regrets because I feel that I've done as well as I can with what I've been given with my resources. Every film I've done has been mostly self-funded by me. You know, I work in a theater, helped me make all my films, and I just deeply love what I do. Deeply love it because film for me, film encapsulates so many art forms, music, art, you know, it's a visual language that is so immersive and it can change lives. You know, it can, I saw this 3 films by an Indian director called Satyajit Ray. It's the Apu trilogy. I don't know if you've seen those 3 films. And I saw that last month and the films were made from 1955 to 1960. And the films really encapsulates the human experience of this one man from his journey from childhood to adulthood. And I saw that film and I was just in tears. And you realize this film was made 67 plus years ago. And it's an Indian film in Bengali. It captures a very specific cultural experience. But me as a Nigerian British man could relate with the themes and the characters. And you realize that film is so powerful. It's a timeless medium that is able to really change perspectives and captivate you. And I was in tears and I was like, wow, this is the power of cinema. And the fact that I am in that field of work is so humbling. You know, I'm so grateful that I get to call myself a filmmaker because it's just an incredible medium.
Speaking of film directors, I know you've been heavily influenced and inspired by the Japanese director Yasujirō Ozu, especially from...
Done your research, man. Oh my God. That's incredible. Wow.
Thank you.
This is awesome.
And the 1953 Tokyo Story.
Yeah.
I saw clips of it and I realized I can see why you'd be influenced by the work of this director. Are there any Nigerian directors that have inspired you as well?
There's actually a Nigerian-American director called Andrew Dosunmu. Andrew made a film called Mother of George that came out 2013. It was shot by Bradford Young, the DP. And Mother of George is a film that really influenced my, that has influenced my work, because the film captures the Nigerian-American experience. You know, Andrew was born in Nigeria. He grew up there. Yeah, just like me, he moved to America, I think, in his early teens. And his work is sort of like captures the diasporic experience of Nigerians in the West. And for me, it just spoke to me deeply, because that's what I'm doing with my own work. His is set in, the film was set in New York, and it captures this woman who is embarking on a marriage. And when you get married in a Nigerian community, there's certain expectations of producing not just a child, but a male child. And we see this character grappling with that because she's unable to have children. And the film really impacted me so much. And it's one of the films that I think has really sort of shaped my visual style as a filmmaker. And also, I, you know, I grew up watching Nollywood films. So I love Nollywood because Nollywood is a very young medium. The first Nollywood film was really made in 1992. I think it was called Living in Bondage, I think Living in Bondage. It's a film that I saw growing up in Nigeria. So Nigerians are resourceful people. You know, we made a cinema out of nothing. No resources, no finances, but we make work that is inherently Nigerian. Work that celebrates our culture, our people, our way of life. And I love the fact that we have basically created something that I think it's the second largest industry in the world, you know, in terms of film output, you know. And so I really love Nollywood. I love the essence of it because it is so truthful. And that's really what I try to do with my work, is capture a very specific truth that really transcends my own cultural boundaries, but it's also universal as well.
I would recommend, if you're not familiar with his work, the works of Herbert Ogundi. He's an amazing film director of yesteryears in Nigeria. And there was a film I actually watched back in Nigeria years ago, and I don't know where I can find it. It's called Evil Encounter. So if you grew up in Nigeria in the 80s, if you know where I can get a copy of this film, please give me a shout. So I have a question to ask you. Do you think there's a distinction between Nollywood filmmaking and filmmaking generally?
Oh, yes, because Nollywood has certain traits and tropes. You know, Nollywood is very, just the stories that are being told, the way they're being told as well. You know, Nollywood films, visually, narratively, is very culturally specific. You know, the work reflects the resources of the filmmakers. You know, the work, you know, explores very specific themes that Nigerians will understand. What I love about Nollywood is it knows who its identity. It doesn't try and embody the West or embody other cultures. It is basically, it forces you to really respect our culture because it is inherently and truthfully Nigerian. And I love that, you know, even though the films aren't always perhaps perfect, but, you know, the essence of it is so raw and so powerful. And they've shaped me. They've shaped the work that I make. So Nollywood is a genre in itself. It's unlike any other film movements or film cultural landmarks. It is so bold, it is so specific, it is so funny, you know, it is just powerful, you know, and I really love it.
So, which leads me to my question to you. What is your quote or proverb you're bringing onto today's episode?
So I really spent some time really thinking about this because, you know, I really wanted to have a quote that really encapsulates who I am. And because, I mean, I'm a filmmaker, the quote has to come from a filmmaker, but not just any filmmaker. This man is the father of African cinema. You guys might have heard of him before. His name is Usman Sembene. Sembene has really shaped my work as a filmmaker. Last week, actually, I saw Sembene's second feature film called Mandabi, which he made in the late 60s. Mandabi is the first African film because it was made in an African language. So when it came out, there had been no films that had made it in an African language. because my daddy came out, I think, in 1967 or 1968. And, you know, it was shown in cinemas all around the world. And that's, I think, really important. And I saw that in cinemas last week. And it's honestly such a beautiful film. It is incredibly powerful and just mesmerizing visually. And I think the language is Wolof, W-O-L-O-F. It's set in Senegal, Dakar specifically. And the film is brilliant. I mean, Black Girl, Sam Bent's first feature film, you know, went to Cannes Film Festival in 1966, I think. It's the first African film. And he's really inspired my work because Sam Bent was a writer for many years. And in his mid-40s, he just had the idea to become a filmmaker because he realized that his work didn't have the sort of wide-reaching impact that he wanted. So he thought cinema is universal, can travel further. So Sam Bent basically taught himself how to make films. And his films have shaped, you know, African cinema. So the quote from Sam Bent is, "Real misfortune is not just a matter of being hungry and thirsty. It is a matter of knowing that there are people who want you to be hungry and thirsty." So that's the quote. Because, and I'll just say it again, real misfortune is not a matter of being hungry and thirsty. It is a matter of knowing that there are people who want you to be hungry and thirsty. There's actually two. I don't know if you mind, there's two quotes I want to share. The second is, "However long it stays in the river, the tree trunk will never turn into a crocodile." And that one is a bit more ambiguous. And I just said that again. "However long it stays in a river, the tree trunk will never turn into a crocodile." So those two quotes have really shaped me as a filmmaker and as an African man. You know, the first is really powerful because Sam Bent made films that were political. They made films that really gave Africa an identity. His films before that, you know, Black people have always been subservient to white people. We've always been captured in a way that is negative, that is troubling, problematic. When Sam Bent made films, he empowered Africans because his films showed us as characters with agency, with purpose, with a voice, with stories that are warranted. And that quote about the fact that knowing the fact that there are people who want you to be hungry and thirsty is really a political awakening that he experienced, that I also experienced, that, wow, there has to be a purpose to my cinema. Because film is such a powerful medium, it has to say something.
That's deep. The second one about the trunk in the river never turning into a crocodile in the end. Could you translate that into Yoruba?
I can't
do it as well.
That one is hard, though. I wish I can. That's hard, though. That's a bit tricky. Come on now. You're the elder here, brother. You should be the one to translate this.
Being the elder has no bearing on this whatsoever. So I have a question to ask you. Would you, sometime along in the next projects you have, incorporate these sayings in any of your works?
I mean, they are incorporated in my life. And I think, as you know, as a filmmaker, my life it represents who I am. You know, my work is a reflection of my identity, my character. I love filmmakers like Ozu, Kurosawa, Ingmar Bergman, so many filmmakers that have inspired my work, who their work is a reflection of who they are. As a filmmaker, you have to know who you are because film is such a subjective, personal experience. And these two quotes reflect who I am, because for me, I think you have to know the world you live in, the realities of what it's like to be a Black man, to be a Nigerian man. And the first quote is about understanding that there are people who want you to be hungry and thirsty. That for me relates to my voice as a storyteller, knowing that I have to take ownership of who I am. I have to tell stories that are authentic and truthful to the Nigerian British experience. I can't rely on others to do that. You know, and for me, The Good Son, my first short film, is emblematic of this quote because I stopped allowing others to tell the Nigerian story. I said, you know what, I am going to take ownership of that, because if someone else tries to tell my story, it will be false. It will be not truthful. So Sam Bent really woke me up, because his cinema is so fierce and so political and so bold. And you're like, that kind of bravery in the 1960s, when there were no resources for Black filmmakers, it's just mind-blowing. So his work has just profoundly impacted me. And these quotes, they live in me. They're a part of me. They're not just stuff that I, that, you know, they're the very essence of who I am, as not just as a filmmaker, but as a person as well.
Speaking of quotes, can you recite any of the lines that you've written in your shorts that has stayed with you to this day?
That's a very good question. There's a film that I made called Marianne. It's a film that I made in 2015. And there's a line in that film that I quite like, because the film is about this man who takes his wife, who's terminally ill. She's dying of cancer. He takes her to this African church because he really believes they've tried all the medical avenues. They've gone to doctors. They've told him that your wife is going to die in a few weeks. You know, get ready, make her comfortable. But he's like, no, I believe that God can cure her. I believe if I take her to a church, being Nigerian, as you know, man, there's a lot of spiritual things we don't understand. I've been to churches where I've seen some incredible things happen. And in this story, I want to encapsulate that, where this man takes his wife to this church because he believes that God can cure her. The film culminates with him seeing the pastor. The pastor prays for her and his wife gets better. Visually, she's awake. She's a lot more active, more alive. But then the pastor tells him that actually God is calling her. And that line, God is calling her, has always stayed with me, because you realize that there's a lot of mysteries to life. There's a lot of things we can't explain. And the fact that, and because I'm a Christian as well, I believe that my purpose, my very existence is shaped by God. And the fact that that line, God is calling her, it has really stayed with me, because you realize that for me, I believe that God is in control of my life. You know, I'm at his mercy. And the fact that this man's wife is going to die is crazy, because for him, his faith was not sort of like activated in the way that he thought it would be. He thought that if he had faith, God will heal his wife. But actually, no, she dies. And he's like, why would God do this? And I love to explore that complexity of serving a God who doesn't always perhaps let things happen the way you want it to happen. You know, and it's tragic as well.
Yeah, I've noticed a theme in some of your short stories, and the theme of belief. Religion, in particular amongst the Yoruba culture, and how we have so much encapsulated our belief in God within our everyday life. Looking at the good son, it starts off with the parents praying. And if you're Nigerian and you're Yoruba or Igbo or even from the north, you know exactly what that's all about. And you address issues of faith and belief, and also grief, because you're only looking at the good son, you're looking at the grief of from the mother's perspective, but also from the son's perspective. And that leads me to your film called Appreciation, whereby you have a lady who is a pastor, and she's befallen with this tragedy. I can never say this word. Tragedy. Damn it, tragedy. She's befallen with this tragedy. And she questions her faith, her belief. Why is the belief system important to you when you're telling your story?
I realize that faith and religion and God is a big part of my life. And I don't want to make Christian films. I mean, that's not the type of cinema I love. And, you know, I love a director called Ingmar Bergman. I don't know if you've seen any of his work. Bergman was a Swedish filmmaker who made films from the early 40s.
The Seventh Seal.
Yep, Seventh Seal. And his work has really profoundly impacted my work, actually, because Bergman makes films that explores the human condition, explores themes around death, around the presence and existence of a God and what that means. And Bergman's film is so introspective and so layered because they leave you with a lot of questions more than answers. And I like to explore that in my work, where I want to make films where they explore faith, because faith is a big part of my life. But I want to make it a very sort of interesting examination of what does faith mean? It's like, why do we serve a God that doesn't always have our best interests at heart? You know, in Appreciation, you know, this character is a pastor who her only son dies. And how can she go on serving a God that takes everything she loves? And I think for me, that's the type of cinema that I love, because it's like, it doesn't make any sense. The fact that we worship a God like this. We serve a God. We believe this God is the all-knowing, all-seeing. And for me, I want to make films that really that explores this complex question of faith and religion, because it makes for great cinema, firstly, but also film, I think, is the perfect medium to explore these issues, to explore these questions that are troubling, that are unsettling, that are difficult to really explain and understand. You know, going back to Bergman made a film called Wild Strawberries. It's a film he made in 1957. And Wild Strawberries is incredible because it explores the journey of a man from, again, childhood to his death. We see him questioning his life, questioning, like, why are we on this earth? You know, what is the purpose of our existence? There's a film by Andrei Tarkovsky. Now, Tarkovsky was a Russian filmmaker, and his films are incredible. He made some films in the late 60s as well, and his films also explore the meaning of our existence. Like, why are we in this world? Does anything even matter? You know, why are we here? You know, what's our purpose? And these questions, they are universal because it affects all of us, regardless of culture, race, class. These are questions that plagues us. Like, where are we going when we die? Is there a God that is watching over us? And for me, I love cinema that basically aspires to explore the nuances and subtleties of life. For me, the kind of films I watch and enjoy are films that are deeply profound and deeply sort of like complex, because for me, I don't have the answers, and I never sort of pose any answers. All I do is give you scenarios that makes you question the very existence of our life and where we're going, but also the mysteries of life as well.
Speaking of the mysteries of life, you directed as part of the I Am series with the 4-8 called I Am Joseph.
Yes.
And this was the first
time. You've done your research.
This was the very first work of yours that I'd seen. And I saw this last year through my wife, Ashanti Omkar. She said to me, you've got to watch this. And we see a black man portraying the life of Joseph from Joseph's perspective. And what was your thinking behind that? The whole idea of casting a black person to play the part of Joseph and making it more of a modern take.
So I was actually approached to direct that film. The producers of that film, they saw my short film Appreciation. They were making a series, they were reimagining biblical characters in a different context. So they saw my film, and then they approached me about directing and writing that film. And, you know, when I read their pitch, I was like, I really think that I'm the right person for this, because as a Christian, I always want to make work that really explores not just Bible characters, but also reimagines them in a different context where they're not always conventional or cliche. And with I Am Joseph, the short film, which is on YouTube, by the way, if you want to watch it, it was very clear from them that they wanted him to be black. And I think, and I love that, because that was also my thinking. I wanted to really reimagine Joseph, because I think growing up and going to church, you know, Joseph is always a Caucasian, Middle Eastern character. And I think that film gives us the license to imagine worlds and characters in a way that perhaps we wouldn't have seen before. And I felt this was a great avenue to really do that, to show Joseph, but show Joseph's struggle. Because we never really hear about Joseph. It's all about Mary. Mary was the one that had a child, and Mary, Mary, Mary. I'm like, how about this guy, man? This guy is told that, you know, his girl, she's going to have a child. It's going to save the whole world. And you know, and it's going to be an immaculate conception.
Like, I'm just
how do you grapple with that?
I'm laughing. I apologize. I'm laughing because I'm thinking of the character from your very short, The Good Son. And I'm thinking, what if Joseph had a mother like the mother from The Good Son? And she finds out that, listen, your fiance is kind of pregnant from God. And how would she react to that? So I apologize. Please continue.
No, that's cool. No. I never actually thought about it. That's a very good point, actually. Yeah. That's interesting because, yeah, I don't think it would have gone well. I mean, like, you know, your wife just had a baby. Exactly. But it's interesting how things are aligned in that sense. But yeah.
is there a character from the Bible? No, I won't even just say character. I don't want to make it sound like a Looney Tune. But is there a person from the Bible or from any religious text that if you were given the opportunity to give your own spin of reimagining, but staying true to the essence of what the story is, what character comes to your mind?
That's a very good point. I'm actually going to, because there's a character that I think I've always been fascinated by, because I love costume dramas. So I've seen period dramas, the Jane Austens, the Jane Eyres, and all the costume dramas that have been made by the BBC. And you know,
you are a weird Nigerian.
Trust me.
And that's a good thing. That's a good thing. Embrace it.
Thank you. Thank you so much. Thank you. I mean, I saw this thing, War and Peace, that the BBC directed. It's a five-part adaptation of the book by the BBC last year. And I absolutely love that because for me, you know, I just like what that transports me to a different time. So period dramas, I really love them because it just really takes you to a place that you never really go to, like, you know, the 18th century, the 19th century. And I'm actually working on a feature film that I'm writing right now, actually set in 19th century London. And we see these black characters who aren't slaves, who aren't servants, who aren't maids. They're actually wealthy, affluent black characters. But there's a particular figure in history. I've always wanted to make a film about his life. And for me, I think it's a shame that no one really has ever done that. And I think for me, the man...
Don't say it, because if you have the idea to do it, someone might listen to this and say, so no.
That's a very good point.
Keep that to yourself, but tell me after the podcast.
That's a very... Thank you for that. That's a really good idea. I don't want people to be taking my ideas, you know, thanks to you, you know, taking my ideas.
So let's now move away from what you've done, and let's go into the realm of imagination. So you have, and I do this with most of my guests, so you have a dinner party inviting six people to come and discuss at this dinner party of yours. You're making, are you vegetarian or do you eat meat?
I eat everything, man. Everything.
Okay. So you're making for your guests a bouillon, the traditional dishes. And you have to choose one film director, who is not Japanese, not Swedish, not Nigerian or African, and has to be female.
Oh, wow.
You have to a female film director, a cinematographer, production designer.
Oh wow! Okay,
composer. I'm running out of people that you do film. Script writer, and a film distributor. And before I forget, may I say your dress sense is amazing. Your dress sense reminds me of the Harlem Renaissance. All the pictures I've seen of you, you've got your waistcoats, you've got your suit, you've got your ties. Kudos. But anyway, back to the dinner party.
Thank you so much. Thank you so much. That's a very good question, actually. So one's a director.
Female director. Writer. Yep, writer.
Script writer. Composer.
Composer.
Production designer.
Yep.
And then distributor as well.
Distributor. So let's forget distributor. Okay, let's go for costume designs. Because you've got production design, but costume design, since you like your...
And the director can't be Nigerian or...
Cannot be Japanese, Swedish, Russian, or Nigerian. Cannot be. It has to be female.
That's a really good... I would say director. A few female directors. Can I maybe choose a British American director then?
Yeah, perhaps? Go for it.
Yeah. Okay. For the American director, I saw a film called Lost in Translation a few years ago, and I remember where I was, what I was eating, what I was wearing, the time of day when I saw that film. It was about 9 years ago, and the film is so profound, and it's a film that every time I see it, I see something new in it. The director actually has come from a very well-known family of directors. So her name is Sofia Coppola, and she, you know, yeah, she's only made like 5 or 6 films, but she has a very specific voice that I respect, and her films are so powerful. So I'll probably have her in my,
Okay.
for the scriptwriter, does it have to be a woman as well?
You can choose whoever you want, anyone.
Okay, scriptwriter. I would say, it'll be an American writer. He's a writer whose work I, again, deeply, deeply love. I recently saw one of his films last month. It's a film called Network. Network was made 1976.
76, Faye Dunaway, yes, and
And his name is Paddy Chayefsky. And as a writer, I mean, he died quite young, and it's a shame because, you know, we could have gotten a lot more films from him, but he died, you know, quite young, but his body of work that he left behind is truly profound. You know, Paddy's writing is so powerful because the way he writes characters, the way he imagines dialogues, but also the social political satire of his work is incredible. All his films, he didn't write that many feature films, but the ones that he wrote are really groundbreaking. So I'll probably invite him to my dinner party.
Okay, so you'll invite Sofia Coppola. You'll also invite Mr. Paddy Chayefsky. Okay, so what's the third one we said?
He said costume design.
Costume design, yeah, costume design.
Oh, that's a very difficult one.
Even if you don't remember the name, if you can just cite maybe a film of which you saw the costume design, so that can work.
There's a film that I saw recently, actually, and it's directed by one of my favorite directors, actually, called Paul Thomas Anderson. Paul Thomas Anderson is an American director whose film like Punch Drunk Love, Magnolia, The Master, you know, they're films that have really shaped my life and influenced my work. PTA, as he's called, made a film called The Master. The Master it's a film that's set in the 1950s, and it's a film that I love a lot. And the name of the costume designer has escaped me, so I'm literally trying to find out what their name is. It's literally escaped me. But the costume in that film, I mean, I love suits. I only wear suits. And my suits are really, I only wear suits from the 1940s, 1950s. And for a very specific reason as well. I love the way that the lapels of those suits were made. And I love films set in that time period. When I saw The Master, I was like, wow, the costume designer like really understands how to accentuate suits in that film. But they've worked with PTA on his other films as well, numerous films. But the name is really, it's literally gone on my mind. I literally, when we go off this, I probably will remember the name, but it's a bit too late. But yeah, I'm going to...
Mark Bridges. The name's Mark Bridges. Google. I'm checking Google. Okay.
Yeah, I was like, I knew it was B. Bridges. Yeah, Mark Bridges, yeah.
Okay.
His work is phenomenal work. And the suit in that film, not just, but the dresses... because, you know, the costume designer is part of the language of cinema. Like costume, the set design, and the visual language are all one. So, it's got to work so well. So, yeah, Mark Bridges.
Who would you go for composer?
Composer? Ooh, this is difficult. There's a young director that I love, a young Black director, and his work has actually profoundly inspired my work. I saw a film he made called Fruitvale Station. He also directed Black Panther as well. And, you know, it's a film, I mean, Black Panther is a cultural landmark. It's a film that is incredibly brilliant. This director has actually composed all the films by Ryan Coogler, the director. Ryan Coogler made a film, you know, the Fruitvale Station, his first film, made a film called Creed, second film. And Black Panther is his third feature film. But he's worked with the same composer that he met when he was in film school, actually. And his name is Ludwig Göransson. You know, he's just like an OG. His work is phenomenal. And
I hate
he's
that
probably
guy.
The composer.
I hate that guy so
really
much.
Really, you do?
Because he's so good. He did the theme tune for The Mandalorian. And he also composed This Is America with Donald Glover.
Donald Glover. He's brilliant.
So you can see why I hate him.
Just, and he's only 34, 35, man. Oh. He's a young, Early 30s, man. He's a young guy. You know, and he recently worked with Chris Nolan on his last film called, what was it?
Tenet.
Tenet, yeah. So, Ludwig is just phenomenal. So I would have him as well.
Okay, all right.
I think, is that everything? Is that?
No, I think we've got, we've done production. We haven't done production design.
Oh, yes. It's a difficult one. So can I name a Russian?
I'll give you a pass, yes.
Yeah, okay. I mentioned his name actually earlier. There's a film called The Sacrifice. Sacrifice is a film by the Russian director, Andrei Tarkovsky. And it's a film that I only saw recently, actually, but I've seen other Tarkovsky's work that he's made. But Tarkovsky, you know, worked with this woman on The Sacrifice. The Sacrifice is a profound film about a man who, the end of the world has come, and he realizes that everyone he knows is going to be wiped out. Not only him, but his whole family. And he makes a vow to God that if God can spare his family, he will give away not only his life, but every worldly thing he has, basically. So in a film which is set in the 1940s, and this man is about to lose everything. You know, this Holocaust will wipe out the whole of humanity, right? And he makes this vow to God. And I mean, it's one of my favorite films. And Andre worked with this production designer called Anna Asp, A-N-N-A-A-S-P. Anna is phenomenal because the production design in that film is so specific. You know, it really is so unique to the film. And when you watch it, you realize how visual it is as well. And it really elevates the film. So Anna's work, she's worked with some of the Russian greats. And she's really inspired my work as well. My approach to production design, because you realize it's a craft in its own and it is so useful and so powerful. So yeah, so she would probably be in that party.
Okay. So what would you serve them?
Oh, these are people from different cultures and backgrounds. So that's going to be quite tricky. We have a Russian woman in there.
They're coming to eat at the table of a Nigerian. You give them what they're going to eat. So exactly. What would you share with them?
It would probably be, I mean, I love Iyan and Egusi. Not only Egusi, Iyan and Eforiro. Iyan is I'm from Osun State. And, you know, this is why I love Iyan. You know, Iyan is such a beautiful dish. And Eforiro is a vegetable-based stew. So I'll probably serve them that. They'll have to like it, you know. I'll serve them that, you know.
So before we come to the end, I have to ask you, of all your favorite directors, living and who have passed away, which of them would you like to direct one of your shorts and bring their own interpretation?
Oh wow, that's tough, man. I would mention this director because I've been watching his work quite recently. He's an Iranian director called Abbas Kiarostami. I recently saw his trilogy that he made from the late 80s to the early 90s. It's called the Koka trilogy. The trilogy has three films. The first is Where is the Friend's House, which he made in 1988. The second is And Life Goes On, which he made in 1992. The third is a film called Through the Olive Trees, which he made in 1994. And what ties these three films is the location. They're set in this town called Koka, which is in Iran. It's a small village in the middle of nowhere. And, you know, I love Kiarostami's work because, again, it's culturally specific, but it transcends cultural boundaries. It is universal. They're films about the human condition. They're films that are so powerful. So, you know, yeah, and I'm only really discovering his work. I've only started watching his work in the past few weeks. So I will probably mention him because there's such profound truth in his work. You know, his work is so layered and multidimensional and just emotional, you know, and his way of seeing people, the way he captures nature, like there's some shots of just trees and birds, and the silences in his work is so profound. So yeah, he's probably somebody who I would love to direct. He died sadly about 9 years ago, but yeah, his work is just, and this is what I mean, how cinema is so powerful, because he's no longer here, but his work will live on for as long as I'm alive, for as long as we have a cinematic medium. Abbas's work will always be there, and the fact that film can outlive its creators is so powerful, because I'm transported to this town called Kuka in the middle of nowhere, a town that I probably would never go to, because I don't have any reason to go to Iran and to go to this town, but it's a town that I feel that I know, because I've seen every part of it. And the way Abbas captures the town, it's just so quiet and so still and so beautiful. So, yeah, probably him.
Which of your shorts would you want him? Would you have wanted him to have directed?
I would just ask him to just create his own work. I wouldn't even, But I think actually Appreciation, because Appreciation explores grief and loss. And, you know, the Kuka trilogy actually is a powerful trilogy, because there's an earthquake that happened in Iran in 1990. And the films explore these characters basically dealing with the aftermath of that tragedy. And, you know, over, I think 70,000 people died in that earthquake. And, you know, the film follows these characters who are trying to rebuild their lives after this earthquake. You know, they've lost their homes, they've lost their, you know, husbands have lost their wives, you know, mothers have lost their children. And it's a profound examination of loss and the power of community and just grief as well. So I would have loved them to direct Appreciation, because my film is about grief, but mine is in the Nigerian community in England. So to see how Abbas Kiarostami will interpret that in his own very unique voice to be very, very powerful.
Okay. So before we finally wrap up this episode, first of all, thank you so much for coming on the show.
No worries.
Really appreciate it. What final words of wisdom from your burgeoning career? Because I say burgeoning because I'm sure there's so much more we're going to see from you. But for those who want to get into the industry, what advice can you give from your point of view?
I think most people would always say, oh, you know, just keep on making films. But I don't think that that's the most important thing. I think the most important thing is knowing who you are, because all these filmmakers I've mentioned, you know, during this chat, all these directors, they know themselves. They have their own specific identity, and that identity is reflected in your work. And that's something that I had to grapple with, because, as I said, you know, coming from Lagos, Nigeria, to this incredibly, I went from an inherently black space to an inherently white space. And I got lost, not knowing who I am, trying to fit in. And I always think, if I was making films, if I hadn't had this awakening of knowing who I am, my films wouldn't have any kind of potency at all, because the films would just reflect someone that isn't truthful to me. So the first thing is, firstly, be comfortable in your own skin, in your own identity, and then find out what your voice is. You know, all the filmmakers I mentioned, you know, like Kiarostami, Paul Thomas Anderson, Tarkovsky, Sofia Coppola, all these guys, their films have a very specific, unique voice. You know, I love Spike Lee. Spike Lee is one of my heroes, because when you see a Spike Lee film, you know you're seeing a Spike Lee film.
Dolly shots.
Those dolly shots, the way the camera comes in, you know, but even just the language, you know, there's going to be black people, you know, there's going to be like, you know, Spike Lee ain't going to be casting some, it's very African-American. It is, you know, I saw Spike Lee's debut recently called She's Gotta Have It. It's a film he made in 1988. And the film is so like beautiful. It's black and white film about this woman who has a sexual awakening. And, you know, navigating what life is like for African-Americans in New York City in the 1980s, like, you know, it's truthfully inherently Spike Lee, because it captures what Spike Lee is about. And I think that when I see that film, I'm like, wow, I want to know what my own version of that is. Like, who am I? Because you have to be a great filmmaker, you have to know who you are. You have to make films that is subjective, but able to sort of like transcend that. Spike Lee film, I mean, I've been to New York once, and I don't know really much about the African-American experience, but I can relate with it through Spike Lee's work. Do the Right Thing, it's a film that is so made in 1991, I think it was. And it's a film that I still watch today. And I'm like, it emotionally affects me, because Spike Lee is taking something that is very subjective to his experience, but made it relatable. know who you are. Find out what your voice is. If you don't know your voice, you know, do you want to make horror films? Do you want to make sci-fi? Do you want to make genre films? Do you want to make quiet dramas? You know who you are. If you know who you are, your films will be powerful. Reflect someone that is very specific to you. You know, there's an American director called Jeff Nichols. Jeff Nichols is just an incredible filmmaker. Nichols makes these quiet dramas, and he's only made like six films, but you can just tell that Nichols is making films that are personal to him. But these films, they explore the worldview of American life and lifestyle. And I understand what that is through his work. So films are a window to a very specific experience. But the experience has to be authentic, because if it isn't, the films wouldn't have any kind of urgency. You know, the films, it wouldn't have any potency. Like I saw Steven Spielberg's Close Encounters of the Third Kind, which he made in the late 70s. You know, the film has inspired a TV series I'm even writing right now about a man who believes that, you know, in his film, this man believes that there are aliens out there. And I love that film because we think, is this man crazy? Is he sane? Is he, you know, are there aliens out there? You know, but it's a character study. And I love that because I've translated that into my own work. But he made a film in the late 70s, and it's set in America, but I'm able to translate that into my own work set in South London, you know? So yeah, like I love this medium because you can be able to translate something that's so unique to you, but it's powerful, man. It's so powerful. So yeah.
Well, I can tell from the way how you talk about film that you're very passionate, and I pray and I hope that that enthusiasm continues long, long, long.
Amio, ami, ami. Miroko Jesu.
Miroko Jesu.
Miroko Jesu.
So, Thomasy, how can people get in touch with you, or how can people get to see more of your work?
So, I mean, I'm on all the platforms, social media platforms. You can find me on Instagram. That's just my name as one word, Tomisin, my first name. And then my surname, Adepeju. I'm on Instagram. I'm on Twitter at Tadepeju. I'm also on Facebook as well. I'm on LinkedIn. You want to find me on LinkedIn. But my work is available on YouTube. If you just type in my name on YouTube, you'll see my films there. It's also on Vimeo as well, Vimeo. You can find my stuff. Yeah, they're all online mostly. So,
okay. Thomasy, may I just say it's been a pleasure. Thank you so much for taking the time out to talk to us. And until next time, be well and Pax Vobiscum.
And I just want to also say thank you to you too, because rarely do we have platforms like this where we get to talk about not only what it means to be African, but in a context of not just film, but, you know, history and, you know, politics and faith and religion. So, when you reached out to me, I was like, wow, it's just incredible that he's making a podcast like this, because we really have safe spaces to talk about what it means to be us. And just thank you for doing this, man. Thank you for creating a platform like this for not just the Nigerian experience, but cultural experiences that people can really express themselves. So thank you so much, bro.
No, thank you so much. I really appreciate it. And I hope, once again, I know I've said this earlier, but I'll say it again. Well, when you do your Oscar speech, I hope and pray your parents are there to see it with you.
Amen.
So that your dad can say, I told him to do this kind of thing rather than law.
Yeah. See, strangely, my parents are now actually, they're now fully immersed in my work. Because I think they've just seen that I'm not going to quit this. So they're now actually overtly passionate. They went from being indifferent now being a bit too much. They're just so intensely now passionate about this. They've been supportive to me.
It's nice.
So supportive.
It's also nice because it's nice to have parents, because I know parents have our best intentions at heart, but I think it's imperative and important that parents don't try and live their lives through their child, but rather they let their child explore what works for them, and they, being parents, give them that support which is needed, because a parent's support can make all the difference at times.
No, you're absolutely right. Because even when I was doing it without their support, it just didn't feel good. No, I'm not a rebel by nature in that way. And, you know, their support means the world to me, because Because I always think about selfishly about my experience coming to this country, but my parents came in their late 30s, early 40s. You know, the transition was hard for me, but it was harder for them. When you come at that age, you've lived your whole existence in a different space. Now trying to find work in England, living in England, you know, it's difficult. It was harder for them, you know, because for me, I could just easily transition into becoming who I am now. But for them, you know, they're still not struggling, but they're still navigating them. I respect them for operating your lives, you know, really kind of established lives and saying, we're going to try out our lives in a different country, not even in like Ghana or in Kenya. It's like, no, in England. So the bravery that I must have taken is just phenomenal. So I respect them deeply.
Well, my hats are off to them as well. Once again, Tommy Sin, thank you so much. And until next time, be well and Pax Vobisco.
Any power of my father's house, that wants to terminate my life,
that wants to terminate my life,
die in Jesus' name.